This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Welcome to PuckCast, a weekly audio dialogue between Pakistan and the West. This is Volume 3, Installment 9 of PuckCast. I'm Ethan Casey, author of Alive and Well in Pakistan.
And I am Nasser Aziz, producer of PuckCast.
This week we have a special installment for you. What will follow is a special half-hour interview that Nasser Aziz and I, along with Keith Snodgrass of the University of Washington Jackson School, did with Siddharth Varadarajan, an Indian journalist who's deputy editor of the Indian national newspaper, The Hindu, and editor of a noted book, Gujarat, The Making of a Tragedy.
And in this interview, we talked to him about various, you know, range of geopolitical issues regarding India, Pakistan, China, Russia, and the U.S., of course. And we talked about Musharraf's role in Pakistan and the ongoing Indian-Pakistani peace process, the whole energy situation in India, Pakistan, Iran, pipeline, China, and a host of various issues.
We interviewed him on March 9th, and today, as we're recording this, is April 17th, so it's been more than a month by the time you hear this. The reason for that is that we got sidetracked into a very important political story in Pakistan itself, which, if you're following events there, you know it's the judicial crisis that's been ongoing. Is a very big deal in Pakistan, and PuckCast has just run a four-week
session on that, yeah.
And so now we're finally able to publish this interview. We're very happy to. I found Mr. Varadarajan a very good interview, very intelligent, sharp, stimulating guy.
Yeah, I liked him very well, and I think he has a good grasp on the situation in India and Pakistan and the region itself, and he seems very knowledgeable, as he ought to be, and yeah. So let's listen to his interview.
And just one more note to say that that we're very grateful to Keith Snodgrass for bringing this interview to
us. Definitely, and I hope he brings more for us.
And we like you, Keith. Keep them coming.
Yep, here we go.
Good evening and welcome to PuckCast. I'm Keith Snodgrass, Associate Director of the South Asia Center at the University of Washington, and I'm very pleased to be joined today, along with Ethan Casey and Nasser Aziz of PuckCast, by Siddharth Varadarajan, the Associate Editor of The Hindu, who spoke on March 9th at the University of Washington and will now be interviewed by Ethan and Nasser.
Thank you, Keith, and welcome to you, sir. Thanks so much for taking a bit of extra time to talk to us and our listeners.
It's a pleasure to be here.
We just before we turned on the microphones, you were talking about Kashmir, and that's an issue that didn't come up in your talk, but it's certainly an issue that's been prevalent between India and Pakistan for 60-some years now.
It's been prevalent for 60 years, and the interesting thing is how much of a distance has been bridged over the past 2 years by India and Pakistan. The kind of new approaches that both countries are considering really represents a major shift in the traditional approach, where Pakistan's original belief was, or original desire was for, or its aspiration was for India to leave, to vacate the territory of Jammu and Kashmir or the parts of Kashmir that India controls or administers. And similarly, the Indian side, its aim was driven entirely by the preservation of status quo. And today, both India and Pakistan have reached a stage where they recognize that the status quo is untenable, and also that territorial adjustments of the kind that Pakistan might have thought about in the past are not going to happen. So in their own way, Musharraf and Manmohan Singh of India have been talking about so-called out-of-the-box solutions. What can we do to bridge this gap? And the two elements on which they've hit upon, one is that we have, if borders can't be redrawn, then can we work to make them irrelevant? And secondly, what can we do to encourage the two parts of Kashmir, the part that India administers and the part that Pakistan administers, what can we do for people that so that people on both sides of the border can interact with each other, can trade with each other, can visit each other more easily. And these two elements are the basis around which there's a lot of diplomacy going on between India and Pakistan at the moment.
So Nasser here. So did Manmohan and Musharraf bring in Kashmiris into this dialogue, or is just pretty much bilateral between India and Pakistan and not the Kashmiris?
The Kashmiris,
it has to be trilateral, or must
I? Well, I think the approach that both sides are taking right now is that the Kashmiris, that no solution is possible without the involvement and consent and approval of the people of Jammu Kashmir. This is very clear. But I don't think either side is at a stage or have reached a stage of understanding, a level of understanding between themselves, where they would feel comfortable talking to the Kashmiris as a separate and distinct third entity. Essentially, the government of India is taking the view that, well, we have a section of the erstwhile princely state of Jammu Kashmir under our, which is part of the Indian Union, and they function within an Indian democratic or parliamentary system. But there are grievances and there are very serious problems which have to be addressed, and we are going to address those through an internal dialogue. And at some point, when Pakistan and India are able to reach a level of understanding, then that understanding will obviously be put to Kashmiri representatives in some shape or form. But I don't think a trilateral dialogue in the way that people had talked about it earlier is at all on the agenda. In fact, the shift away from the trilateral dialogue proposal is really what has happened in the last 2 years, where Pakistan has also dropped its insistence that Kashmiri representatives have to be present in our dialogue. I think the understanding is, let us try to reach an understanding by ourselves first, come up with something which hopefully the people of Jammu and Kashmir and the people, the wider publics in both Pakistan and India will feel comfortable living with. I think that's really the project that they're working on.
As a journalist who spent quite a bit of time in Indian-controlled Kashmir in the mid-90s, I met many Kashmiris who basically set a plague on both their houses. They really were a lot less sympathetic to Pakistan than I expected most ordinary Kashmiris to be. And one, just sort of supporting the points that you were making, one old man I spent a lot of time with said, when two elephants fight, it's the grass that gets trampled. And maybe if the elephants can decide not to fight, and that would be good for the grass.
Yeah, exactly. I think the people of Jammu and Kashmir are the ones who suffer the most. The estimates of the number of Kashmiris who've died in this conflict vary widely from, say, 30,000-40,000 up to perhaps even up to 100,000. These are innocent people who've been killed either by the security forces or by armed extremists. And there is really a need to put a closure to this, put an end to this. And it has to be done through a solution which would honor and respect the suffering and trauma that the people of Jammu and Kashmir have gone through. So I think any solution which does not reflect the aspirations of the people of Kashmir in some way would not be acceptable to them. But I think India and Pakistan would have to be mindful of that sensitivity. And I think the elephants, as you say, have decided that it's not worth our while to either trample grass or fight among ourselves, simply because we can't produce a result that way. I think the Kargil War of 1999 showed Pakistan that military options are finished. You cannot get territory through war. And India also recognizes that there is no military solution to the problem of insurgency. You have to tackle it through a dialogue process. And I think that's really what's underway right now.
Keith here. Generally, progress has been made, I think, from the Indian perspective at least, on the Kashmir issue when Pakistan has been ruled by a military government. Do you think that the current government in India feels pressure to try to move this process forward with the current government and not wait for a potential civilian government to come in?
No, that's a good question. I think after a lot of soul searching, the government of India, which was initially very, very suspicious and skeptical of Musharraf, because Musharraf, after all, was the architect of Kargil War. He was the army chief when the Pakistani military essentially you know, tried this surreptitious invasion of territory that India controlled. So there is a link. There was lingering suspicion of what Musharraf stands for, what his hope, what his aim is. But I think after Musharraf himself began to be targeted by terrorists, there was an armed attack on his life in 2003. Then again in 2004. Recently, again there was another attack. I think this has convinced the Indian government that Musharraf has, for better or worse, and for whatever reason, adopted a certain set of policies that have made him very unpopular with a certain section of Islamic extremists. And to that extent, to the extent to which he says that he wants enlightened moderation in Pakistan and a peaceful settlement of the Jammu Kashmir problem and of out-of-the-box solutions, to the extent to which he is willing to admit that a plebiscite, the old Pakistani stand of a plebiscite, is not feasible anymore, to the extent to which he is willing to acknowledge that there can be no territorial readjustments or division on the basis of religion. These all provide a basis on which we can work with Musharraf. So the answer to your question really is that, yes, I think there is growing recognition in India that Musharraf is the man that we must do business with. And to the extent to which his own future as administrator or president of Pakistan is in doubt. I mean, whether he will, well, I'm sure he will win the election that he's going to stand for later this year. But in the future, what happens is a question mark. And I think that's why there is a kind of urgency on the Indian side that let's take the dialogue process forward and see what comes out of it.
In your very interesting talk tonight, you talked about many other topics, and in fact, I don't believe Kashmir was talked about at all in either your talk itself or the question and answer afterwards. And I overheard you mention that you're writing a book. Tell us about your book.
Well, the book is essentially on the same topic on which I spoke, which was the idea of, it's looking at the evolving relationship between the United States and India through the prism of what I call the outsourcing of hegemony. The United States, because one of the big stories of the 21st century is the concerted attempt being made by the United States to bring India onto its side in military terms and strategic terms, and the centerpiece of this effort is the offer that the United States makes in July 2005 to India of the restoration of full civilian nuclear cooperation, peaceful civilian nuclear cooperation. And my argument is that this, the offer of nuclear cooperation and the wider relationship in which it is embedded is essentially designed by the United States to get India to play a certain kind of role in Asia that will be conducive to the preservation and extension of American hegemony into the 21st century. And I looked at some of the tension and some of the problems that this kind of approach may produce from the Indian perspective, and of course left open the question of what India would finally decide, whether India would be interested in playing the role of a outsourcer of American hegemony in Asia, or whether it's in India's interest to be more vigorous in the defense of its own independent foreign policy. And that's really the point that I tried to analyze, and that's what the subject of my book is going to be.
And I think ultimately you're skeptical of the outsourcer role.
Yes, I don't think India is going to. I mean, the analogy that I gave in the talk, and which I like to give, is this whole debate as to whether India will, what kind of role will India play in Asia? Will India be a Britain? In other words, Britain is in Europe, but also has very strong transatlantic bonds, and it's questionable to what extent Britain has a European identity and European loyalties. Certainly, it's not a prime mover of European initiatives. It's really France and Germany that take the lead on that. So will India play the role of Britain, or will it play the role of a France, which contributes to Asia and Asian security and Asian initiatives, while at the same time contesting certain aspects of American hegemony? I think India is more likely to contest in the long term, certain American initiatives in the region. But my fear is that it's not enough to contest or not acquiesce. India has to play a more active role in the creation of Asian architecture or Asian institutions that can help to resolve some of the conflicts that the United States has been taking advantage of in Asia, or has been exacerbating. And this is really where I'm not very sure what India, what Indian foreign policy is going to do. We saw in the Indian votes against Iran at the International Atomic Energy Agency that India was susceptible to American pressure. The Indian government took the view that if we don't vote against Iran in the IAEA board, then the nuclear deal with the United States will be jeopardized. And so they said, okay, no, the deal is more important than what whatever happens to our relationship with Iran. And they voted against Iran, which in my view was a mistake. And it was a mistake, you know, primarily because it has helped to escalate the conflict between Iran and the United States and pushed us further and further away from the possibility of a diplomatic solution.
Sorry, speaking of that conflict, what will become of it?
Iran?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Iran, I'm afraid we are on an escalator which is going up, and which either we find a way to get off it quickly, and this is an escalator of coercion and sanctions which can end up in only one place, which is the danger of war. People often forget that the invasion of Iraq in 2003 comes as the culmination of a decade-long policy in which not just the Bush administration but the Clinton administration insists on the imposition and maintenance of sanctions which crippled every aspect of Iraqi life. And it's at the end of that period, when the rest of the world grows tired of these sanctions and says, look, enough's enough, that you then have the war. Now, at what stage are we at in Iran? Sanctions have only just begun. I don't believe that the American military is ready to take military action. But a year or two or 3 years later, who's to say? So at some point, I think the American strategy is to follow a method of a tactic of coercion and hope that at some point the Iranians will do something foolish, such as maybe walk out of the NPT, walk out of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, or cut their ties with the International Atomic Energy Agency, which could then arguably serve as an excuse to bomb Iranian nuclear facilities. So I think that's the trajectory in which we are at. I don't see the prospect of dialogue right now, because the current approach of the Bush administration does not lend itself. There's very little evidence that they are looking for diplomatic solutions. Various options that were available in the past of a dialogue were rejected, were not acted upon. And today, you know, if we're talking about imposing a travel ban and, you know, a ban on weapons exports and all kinds of other things that are being pursued at the Security Council, these are not measures which are going to convince the Iranians to accept what the United States is saying. Anybody who understands Iranian culture and their civilization and society and politics will tell you that coercion, pressure, sanctions are the last thing that's going to work, and that you will invariably end up in a situation where you will have to apply harsher and harsher sanctions because you can't climb down once you go that way. And ultimately, you have no option but to either suffer an ignominious defeat by withdrawing, by saying, okay, fine, I was wrong, or you try to transcend or transform the situation by coming up with an excuse to go to war. And that's really the direction in which we're going, I'm afraid.
I'm going to steer you back to the Kashmir issue. And it's like a hot topic between Indians and Pakistanis. So basically, India holds Pakistan responsible for the insurgency within Indian-held Kashmir, or Indian-administered Kashmir, I should say, to Pakistan. And then at the same time, India has a huge military presence in Indian Kashmir. And there's lots of reports of human rights violations and atrocities committed against Kashmiris. So how does India address that issue?
Well, India is under a lot of pressure. Because the public opinion in Kashmir, which at one point had, Ethan, you're sort of talking about your own impression in the 90s. People were upset at what Pakistan was doing, also upset at what India is doing. But there was a period of time when human rights abuses had come down in Indian-administered Kashmir. And that coincided with the general, you know, public frustration with Pakistan as well. But somehow the Indian establishment has not been able to take advantage of that. And the human rights problems, which basically stem from the over-dependence of the Indian state on military means, to basically crush the insurgency or the armed extremists in Kashmir, has produced a number of civilian casualties, people who've disappeared. I still don't think the level and scale of the human rights violations today are similar to what we saw in the 90s, say. So the situation is much better than the 90s, but it's still intolerably high what's happening. And there is pressure from Kashmiri civil society. You have demonstrations now regularly when civilians are killed, which and also from civil society in the rest of India, that this has to stop and that you can't have a solution. Manmohan, the Prime Minister has said that there should be zero tolerance towards terrorism. And I have written that, yes, zero tolerance towards terrorism, but also zero tolerance towards human rights violations. But the Indian government does not take that very seriously. Armed forces personnel involved in human rights violations, even when cases are filed, which often they are not, do not get prosecuted. They do not get sent to jail. And I think this is a serious credibility issue. As for the issue of troops, well, Pakistan has consistently maintained that part of the settlement has to involve the drawing down and withdrawal of demobilization of the overwhelming Indian Army presence from civilian areas. The government of India, I suspect, would like to do that, but is not in a position to do so right now because you have a number of attacks that continue to take place by insurgent groups. I think as the dialogue process between Pakistan and India gathers speed and takes on a more concrete form, and Pakistan is able to prevail on some of the insurgent groups and some of the extremist groups like Lashkar-e-Taiba, Jaish-e-Mohammed, it's possible that as the level of violence, cross-border violence, comes down.
Quick question, these troops, these attacks by the militants, are these on civilians or Indian Army?
Both. There are a number of incidents which take place in which civilians have been victims. But the pattern essentially is the following, that whenever civilians are killed, the insurgent groups never claim responsibility for it. The Hurriyat, which claims to speak in the name of Kashmiri freedom, even when innocent Kashmiris are killed, will blame the Indian security forces for those incidents, even though there's very little evidence that they would have done that particular thing. Most of the time, for example, they've planted bombs which have killed civilians, or they've shot civilians who they say are informers. They've killed family members of mainstream political party politicians. So a number of civilians have been targeted by and I think had the insurgency remained at the level of violence against soldiers alone, Pakistan and the insurgent groups would not have had such a big PR problem as they have today. But the problem is that Pakistan, in fact, it encouraged in the early 90s when the shift in the insurgency took place away from the JKLF towards Hizbul Mujahideen. The Pakistani military, in a sense, encouraged them to use certain kind of tactics, which ultimately discredited these forces in the eyes of many people around the world. And so I think that to come back to your original question, I think there is an urgent need for the number of Indian soldiers in JNK to come down and for them to be replaced by normal police. And ideally, even the total volume of these forces have to come down, not just army, but paramilitary police. That can happen and should happen, and I think it will happen as this dialogue process gathers steam. But an important component of that is the need for a ceasefire. I think if in 1999 there was a ceasefire which lasted 10 days between the Hizbul Mujahideen, which is the primary insurgent group, and the Indian Army, and then later that year, over Ramadan, but it lasted about 8 months, the Indian Army had a unilateral ceasefire. And this again led to considerable fall in the amount of violence. So I think we really need the India-Pakistan process to move rapidly towards a situation where a ceasefire on the ground can be effected, because that would create the circumstances which would make, because don't forget, politically, the Indian government has to deal with an opposition that is very hawkish on Pakistan and is prepared at the drop of a hat to cry sellout that you are giving, bartering away Indian rights and Indian territory. So all of these things have to be very carefully calibrated. I was at a dinner in Delhi about 2 weeks ago when Khurshid Kasturi, the Pakistani foreign minister, had come for talks. And it was a dinner for him by the Pakistani High Commissioner. And he made a very interesting point. He said that the dialogue that we are having together, India and Pakistan, is confined to a handful of people right now because the issue is very sensitive and the solutions we are thinking about are very out of the box. But as and when the solutions mature, they can only be implemented if the opposition and the media and people of Kashmir come on board and the people of India and Pakistan come on board. And I think this is really absolutely crucial. And a troop withdrawal today by the Indian government, in the absence of, say, a ceasefire that is worked out, would be politically very, very problematic, because the Bharatiya Janata Party, the opposition party, would go after them and say, look, you are selling out and make all kinds of allegations. So I think this has to be very carefully calibrated, but I think things are going in the right direction.
And I have one regional question. Like, wouldn't it make more sense for Kashmir issue to finally resolve at some point, and India, Pakistan, Iran, Afghanistan, Russia, and China create like an energy, political, and strategic bloc and kind of keep America out of the whole region as a big player? What do you think about that?
I think there's no need consciously to keep America out. America is in right now, but America is in right now precisely because of our inability to resolve our problems by ourselves. The more suspicion there is, the more enmity there is, and the more differences that there are between Iran, Pakistan, India and China, India and Pakistan, and so on. This is something which an outside power can take advantage of and has taken advantage of in the past. So there is every reason why India and Pakistan, you know, and energy is an excellent example. I think you're right to focus on that. And I would say that energy offers us the best window right now, because you have the Iran-Pakistan-India pipeline project, which in economic terms may not be that important, although it is. But can you imagine the implications of Pakistan and India creating codependence on each other? It's a wonderful thing, because it acts as a restraining mechanism. If Pakistan is earning $600 million a year in revenues, transit revenues from India, that gives India some leverage over Pakistan. And if Indian industry, in certain Indian factories, depend on the peaceful, uninterrupted flow of gas through Pakistani territory, that gives Pakistan leverage over India. So this kind of codependency is the basis on which a wider set of confidence building measures can be built, and a new kind of equation or interaction can evolve. And it's ironic that this one project, which really opens up the prospects for a new relationship between India, Pakistan, and Iran, is being so strongly opposed by the Bush administration. They say that, no, don't do business with Iran. And, you know, they don't understand that if this pipeline doesn't come through, forget about the damage it may do to Iran, which is minimal, because Iran can always sell its gas to somebody else. But India and Pakistan will lose the possibility of a cooperative venture, which is a really unique project. Because until now, don't forget, Pakistan has refused to enter into normal economic intercourse with India, because it has said, solve Kashmir first. Only if you solve Kashmir first am I prepared to normalize trade. But the pipeline is the first time that Pakistan is prepared to set aside Kashmir and say that, no, energy is more important than anything else. Let us get this project going. And so it's a win-win for both countries. So for the United States to oppose it at this time, I think is a very negative, sends a very negative signal to the region. Because if the pipeline were to come, not only does it improve ties between India and Pakistan, but Iran gets a stable market for its gas. We can even think about connecting the Iranian grid extends all the way up to the Caspian in the north, and it's not difficult. It's not maybe a small pipeline can be built to hook up the Iranian grid to Turkmen gas or to gas supplies from Kazakhstan, which then allows India to draw on Central Asian gas, and it opens up and Pakistan as well. And if we think that the pipeline which goes from Iran, Pakistan, and India can be extended across North India into northern Burma and then into the Yunnan province of China, this allows China and southern China to draw on Iranian gas without relying on expensive, liquefaction and CNG tankers and so on and so forth. So this really, energy cooperation built on the basis of friendly relations opens up an entirely new set of possibilities for Asian integration. And I think it's not a coincidence that the U.S. is opposing this pipeline for that reason.
So is this like a divide and rule policy and isolating Iran and giving India the nuclear technology? Is that the whole part of the game?
Well, I think India has a right to nuclear technology. And incidentally, I think Pakistan does too, because Pakistan and India are two countries which never accepted the NPT. And we, in 1998, declared ourselves as nuclear weapon states. And we did nothing illegal. Neither Pakistan nor India broke any international law because we did not violate a commitment that we never signed a commitment. So there's no question of a violation. So it's unfair that the world should deny India and Pakistan civilian nuclear technology. It's fair enough that they have concerns about the safety and proliferation aspects. And I think India and Pakistan can and should be willing to evolve safeguard mechanisms so that this any imports are not misused and the world can be confident about that. But it is the right of India and Pakistan to have nuclear cooperation. Similarly, Iran is a non-nuclear weapon state under the NPT. So it has committed not to acquire nuclear weapons, but the NPT gives it the right to access all aspects of the civilian fuel cycle. And the United States is saying Iran should not have that. So the answer is not to deny India and Pakistan, but to try to address the Iranian issue in an objective manner. Can we design mechanisms that will allow Iran to fulfill its rights to the fuel cycle under the NPT, and which at the same time can give the world confidence that Iran is not going to at some point in the future develop a clandestine nuclear weapons program? And I think it is possible to craft mechanisms for the political and technological mechanisms which can allow us to do that. But the United States' current approach towards Iran is completely irrational. If anything, it's going to drive them towards, because the more vulnerable you make a regime feel, the greater is the likelihood that that regime is going to turn towards nuclear weapons as a means of ensuring its security. And North Korea is an excellent example. I mean, I was in Iran last year in August, and incidentally, I didn't meet anybody who supports Iran getting a nuclear weapon. Even the so-called hardliners never went that far. But what they did, one scholar told me about how the Iranians look at video footage. They looked at video footage of Saddam Hussein being captured from a foxhole and his teeth being examined and his head being examined on international television. And you then look at Kim Jong-il of North Korea, who possesses nuclear weapons and exploded a device in October last year. And contrast, so Saddam never had weapons and he was invaded. North Korea had weapons, and you have a dialogue process which results in North Korea being given concessions and so on. And this person asked me, well, what kind of message do you think that sends the Iranians? And so clearly, I think, regime change as a policy is perhaps doing more to further the cause of nuclear proliferation than anything else. And I think the Bush administration really needs to look very carefully at some of these policies and do a course correction, because they've already lost the game in North Korea. North Korea went nuclear. Let us not create a situation where hardliners in Iran feel compelled to go down that way because of regime security. It's far better to guarantee the security of their regime through political means, evolve confidence-building measures that would, as I said, allow Iran to exercise its rights and also give the world the confidence that Iran is not developing nuclear weapons. It's not difficult to do that.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.